A little more than 30 years ago, a good friend of mine married, and I was really excited for her, except I harbored a small concern. She is a very politically progressive thinker, and her fiancé was not. And there are many differences I imagine couples might learn to manage extreme politics, political differences, not being one of them. But then I hadn't been married very long at that point, so what did I know? Still, I had trouble imagining, and I wonder if you do, that something that feels like such a fundamental distinction, and I don't mean Democrat versus Republican so much as what I felt it represented, what I perceived as, on the one hand, my friend's forward-looking, open to change, progressive mindset versus her fiancé's more conservative, you know, stability-oriented establishment perspective. I couldn't imagine common ground or a sufficient basis for trust that would endure the challenges of married life. In effect, it felt to me as though her rock was not his rock. They were standing in very different places, and how would that work? And they are still married. So I wonder what I was missing. It may be that they are smarter than I was, for starters. Clearly, other things have been sufficiently bonding for them over these many decades. And maybe there are more ways to understand our differences, which often translate into political distinctions, though not always. Maybe there are more ways than I had appreciated at the time. Without revealing any particular secrets, I wonder if there are any among us this morning who are partnered with someone profoundly different in this way. Okay, I said don't reveal any differences, but I did wonder if you were gonna like, we are. But maybe not, because if we fast forward to 2019, we are ever more aware of our divisions these days. Progressives and conservatives, and it feels more critical than ever to figure out how we might be missing an opportunity to understand each other better, lest there be, as it feels right now, no room for trust whatsoever, not to mention room for love. And I would remind you of our poor shepherd who is trying to figure out how to work with a new mentor who has a different set of priorities and asks instead for someone different, rather than trying to work through some of those opinions. Remember the suggestion that we love our neighbors as ourselves? In our meditation this morning about standing up for those who have no voice. I'm not sure that invective to love our neighbors as ourselves or to stand up or listen to others was only about those oppressed or in lesser situations. It was not just either the neighbor whose political persuasions we agree with or whose situation we can help. I heard someone mention yesterday that there are many members of their own family with whom they simply do not speak as a result of political differences. I don't think that's an unusual observation, but it feels like quite a large loss. It's not a new division, this conservative-liberal thing, if we remember our readings from this morning between Parker and Emerson and Mr. Bellows, nor one exclusive to politics. The tension, as we heard again this morning, between freedom of individual expression and the need for institutional stability, that all by itself is not unfamiliar to us, nor has it finished being a bone of contention in our tradition. No doubt you'll remember the event several weeks ago in Washington, D.C., when the young man, the boy really, was standing face to face with the Omaha elder. And I noticed a comment from a colleague about the two groups, not just the two individuals, but the two groups, having different moral intuitions. She referenced moral intuitions. That was her description of what was going on, if not what produced the event to begin with. different moral intuitions. The phrase caught my attention, especially as I had been writing during that week about moral imagination relative to Parker's claim about the arc of the universe and its bending. Maybe Parker's best gift to us, I wrote at the time, is not his insistence that the arc is bending, but the moral imagination to encourage us towards that end. The trajectory of the arc may be more a function of moral engagement as a starting point than where we eventually put our hands to service. And I continue several weeks later to believe that's accurate, but I'm guessing that in my mind at the time, a sense of morality was a particular construct that we would need to agree on in order to understand each other. In effect, a kind of universal moral basis of right and wrong. I don't think that's an uncommon assumption, and it was why I was concerned about my friend's choice of partners 30 years ago. I imagined that, among other things, they didn't see right and wrong in the same way, perhaps. And then I saw this comment about moral intuitions and their variability that got me wondering. So I followed the thread forward to the work of social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who we also heard from this morning. I wonder if he's familiar to any of you. A few. He has been, along with a small group of colleagues, studying and observing what they are calling the moral foundation theory. If we imagine foundation, as in what we stand on. Until fairly recently in academia, moral psychology was assessed in the realm of developmental psychology. It had to do with your age and your stage of development, and Haidt offers a different approach. He says, if you think that moral reasoning is something we do to figure out the truth, you'll be constantly frustrated by how foolish, biased, and illogical people become when they disagree with you. He might say when we disagree with them, but he didn't. But if you think about moral reasoning as a skill we humans evolved to further our social agendas, to justify our own actions, and defend the teams we belong to, then things will make a lot more sense. He talks about our acquiring morals the way we acquire language, that we learn how to speak in particular environments. So we imagine we learn English among English speakers and other languages among other languages. And similarly, that we create virtues and narratives and institutions that reflect the moral priorities of those environments. Our moral communities consist of collective views of right and wrong, some of which may overlap across communities, but likely not all. So this all gets a little complicated, and I know it's a lot to absorb and think about, but I'm going to ask you to hang in there with me, and I'm going to try to make it illustrative so we have a place to put it. I think it's amazingly interesting, and I also think it's especially relevant to our world today. So the basic premise of moral foundation theory is that our morals are developed over time based on reactions to six different areas. So we imagine the rock, right? On the cover of your order of service are two separate rocks. Imagine one rock, big enough to include all of it. It is the foundation, let's say, on which our morals are based. So we have the one rock, and it looks a little like a bar chart. It's big and flat, and it has a y-axis. So for any of you who get that right, there's the horizontal rock, and then there's the vertical y-axis that we're measuring, right? Across the bottom of our rock are six labels going across what we might think of as the x-axis. The first one is labeled harm and care. It is the place where kindness and gentleness and nurturance reside, harm and care. The second is fairness and cheating, where the ideas of justice and rights exist. So moving across the axis, the next one is loyalty and betrayal. the place of tribalism and patriotism, of group thinking. Number four is authority subversion. It is where the respect for traditions and deference to authority resides. So we're almost there, we've got four. Number five is sanctity and degradation, relating to the notion of noble living, things that are sacred to us, virtuous, often referenced as some control of our bodies. And lastly, liberty and oppression, which is the home to dominating forces or the resentment of them. So we have these six areas of moral foundation that apply to all human beings. And Haidt's premise is that liberal thinkers heavily weight the first two bars. So we're over here, not surprisingly from my perspective, on the left. But we also prioritize the last one relative to the others because they value care. So the first two value care for each other way up here, right? Way high on the x-axis. Actively pursuing the rights of others, women, children, any beings marginalized. The liberal voice is not so worried about groupthink or patriotism. The liberal moral understanding is not especially interested in tradition or authority figures, even. That's where our individualism comes in, right? Don't tell me what to do or think. I get to choose. And we don't want anybody, oh, I made this assumption there. Liberal thinkers don't want anybody telling them what noble living relative to their bodies is about. Don't tell me what I can or can't do. And lastly, in general, liberal thinkers attend to the idea of dominating forces. So there are two bars over here on the left, very high, and one out here on the end. By contrast, he suggests, the conservative thinker scores relatively evenly across all six arenas. They care about harm, they are invested in the idea of fairness, but perhaps not to the extreme as the liberal thinker. They prioritize loyalty to institutions much more highly than to individuality. And again, I invite you to reflect on our own Unitarian Universalist tensions around that idea. The conservative thinker is more respectful of tradition and authority, especially as it pertains to the structures critical to community life. I.e., they value what makes the whole stronger than the individual differences within it. They have a strong sense of valuing virtues as defined by bodily behaviors, and they generally agree with the idea of liberty. So all of those are roughly on this similar plane. So let's pause and think back again to the readings about Parker and Emerson versus Bellows, the institutionalist. Our dreamers are holding up the flag of individualism in our tradition, but would we even be here if Bellows had not solidified the structures to keep us in relationship across congregations, that is, not individually? So again, back to Haidt's work, it's not intended to judge the results of our moral choices, only to observe them as a way of understanding how we're separate. Not that either side is inherently more or less moral than the other, only that we prioritize different aspects of the moral foundations that we all share. The problem arises, and of course there's a problem because we're human, and we're people, and that's what we do. It arises when our righteousness, the very thing he credits with making it possible for us to cohere, becomes self-righteousness, wherein we insist on the correctness of our priorities. The very thing that binds us becomes what divides us, as we are blinded by our respective sacred cows. We forget that in order to understand others, not let alone change them, we must understand ourselves and who we are. Our ability to stay connected to the truth is dependent on our willingness to remember that everyone has a reason for what they're doing, which requires what Haights calls moral humility, and our self-righteousness gets in the way. Truth and good policy only emerge, he suggests, from the contest of ideas, when we challenge each other's biases. But when we no longer make room for that in our discourse and in our interactions, the system that assures balance is broken. The rock we're standing on isn't functioning for us. When we assign evil to one side or the other, then our common rock can no longer contain us. We're here, they're there, and we never meet. He quotes the 8th century wisdom of Sen San. The perfect way is only difficult for those who pick and choose. Do not like, do not dislike, and all will then be clear. Make a hairbreadth difference, and heaven and earth are set apart. If you want the truth to stand clear before you, never be for or against. The struggle between for and against is the mind's worst disease. So Haight is careful to clarify that he doesn't really believe we should live out this way of Sen San. In fact, he says, I believe that a world without moralism, without gossip and judgment, would quickly decay into chaos. But if we want to understand ourselves, our divisions, our limits, and our potentials, we need to step back and look at the game we're playing. I think we can easily imagine for and against in the 21st century. It looks like Facebook telling you what you want to hear and see. It looks like Google confirming your every bias. It looks like Fox News and MSNBC. It looks like politicians saying compromise is the equivalent of failure. It looks like the image of a young man, a boy really, standing face to face with a native elder, not in common cause, but in defiance. It looks like a government shutdown. It looks like declining church participation because it's easier not to worry about the welfare of others or to commit the time to creating and sustaining community. You are the exception, by the way, to that rule, and I'm very grateful. I wish I had the panacea for the dilemma that we now exist in. I fear we are fairly far gone down the judgment trail. Our lives have become what Haight calls lifestyle enclaves. He goes so far as to suggest that we are living in consensual hallucinations. Isn't that a great phrase? What we might imagine as our own bubbles, right? Consensual hallucinations, and all of us far from the truth, perhaps. He does offer some correction. It's not entirely hopeless. And it may not surprise you that it has to do with the moral humility. It is imperative that we stop demonizing each other, stop pointing at them and calling them evil. We can't control the response. We can only manage our own, right? There's a difference between disagreement and vilifying. I will point out that the subtitle of Haight's book is The Righteous Mind, but the subtitle, When Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics. I'm not sure where that leaves bad people, but perhaps that's another sermon. So our opportunity here. I think one of the particular challenges that we as Unitarian Universalists continue to face is the historical one presented earlier. Our focus on individuality that can blind us to the benefits of a focus on the need for group cohesion. I wonder if it's hard to hear that it's not about us, each of us, and what we on our own journeys can be, but about what we can be together on behalf of a better world. and then what we can offer that world as a resource on humility. Tolstoy is said to have quipped, "Everyone thinks of changing the world. No one thinks about changing themselves." It's hard work, this moral humility, this opening the door to the possibility of common moral grounding. But isn't that where we'd rather be, in a world where we actually try to listen to each other and to offer each other our imperfect humility, even as we share our own perspectives? So I have two or three challenges for you this week. The first is to think about someone you may disagree with and find a time to even possibly have a conversation that might help you better understand the ground they are walking on. How is their very foundational understanding of the world and its needs contributing to the differences you two experience? If you're a little fuzzy on your own grounding, you can check it out at yourmorals.org. Don't you love that? According to this website, you can learn about your own morality and your ethics and your values. It is kind of interesting. This is Haight's website, by the way, while also contributing to scientific research. Yourmorals.org. Lastly, and this will apply to some of you more than others, of course, because so many of you are already doing this, but think about the institution that is this church, how it serves you as a spiritual seeker, and as importantly, how it serves others. And imagine how you might be more engaged as a part of that. I am not a rampant institutionalist, but I do believe in the value of faith community. And all of us, it requires all of us to participate. And as our choir encouraged us, to have a little faith in each other. I hope we can be a part of a movement that encourages us all to stand on the same rock again, even across our differences. Let us work on that.